It's the most wonderful Thursday in April, Jules, because the sun is shining and you're laughing and we're good to go. Welcome back. It's the Gab and Jules Show. Jules, first of all, I know you're dying for this. You were waiting for this. I do have my piece of memorabilia today.
Go on.
To introduce to you. Now, I'm just going to put this on.
Oh, my God.
Can you tell what that is?
Yes, Metro Stars, your favorite team ever.
This is an original New York, New Jersey Metro Stars from the 1996 season. Yep. I was there. I was a partial season ticket holder. I was there when the first goal, I've mentioned this before, I just mentioned it again because I think it's funny. The first goal in the history of the New York, New Jersey Metro Stars, who of course would later become the New York something owned by some fizzy drinks brand, yeah. And Thierry Henry's team, was scored. And it was an own goal by Nicola Caricola, former Juventus and Bari defender. So, and I was there that day.
Good. I bet that cap is worth a lot, you know.
Right.
I don't think there's many left, surely.
45 cents on eBay? Come on now. We should get Charlie Stilettano on and see if
exactly.
he wants to and see if he wants to buy it back off me.
You know when MLS opens a museum, because they all do that eventually at some
exactly.
point. You should send, they would be looking for those.
Damn straight. Anyway, let's talk about what's happening around Europe because UEFA are having their, they're not meetings, they're video conferences this week. On Tuesday yeah. they went with the 55 member associations. On Wednesday they met, and if you're cynical, you might say, well, this is what really matters, with the clubs association and the leagues. A little later today, whereas we're taping this Thursday morning, there's the executive committee are going to meet. Our understanding is that their line's going to be, guys, it's too early to go and really decide anything, and there's not going to be any real update. However, some people think there's a bit of a softening. Originally, it was reported that, you know, when it was around the time that Belgium stopped playing.
Yeah, at the beginning of April, yeah.
Yeah, they were pretty strong saying, oh, no, you know, you should finish the league. And I was skeptical, if you recall, and I said, look, UEFA aren't saying, oh, you have to do it, otherwise you'll be kicked out. UEFA are under pressure from leagues. Leagues and clubs want to – they really want to start playing again, or they want to be seen to make every effort to start playing again. And so if on top of that you have UEFA saying, guys, you better start playing, otherwise we can't guarantee your spot in the Champions League next year, then that's in their interest. But even today, we're, you know, the line, I think, coming out from the UEFA statement was, you know, they were told that they would like them to finish the leagues.
Yeah.
You know, so it's softening up. And we just saw Holland – bow out, the Eredivisie government saying no organized football until September. The Dutch FA, the KNVB, they're going to respond to this on Friday, but it looks like they're done too, Jules.
Yeah, and it's interesting first to see that it's not a footballing decision taken by football authorities, but by the government, who said, I don't care if you're football, hockey, and whatever they're good at, you know, it's just there will be no sport or not that kind of sport until a certain date. So then you have to follow what your government is saying. And I think a lot of people forget that it's not whoever eventually will decide. It's neither UEFA, FIFA, the leagues, the Premier League or Ligue 1 or the Serie A or the Italian Federation or French Federation. It will be the government and the health minister, for example, who are going to say it's still not safe to be playing. We can't play until so and so. I mean, the World Health Organization, for what it's worth, said yesterday as well that you shouldn't play football until 2021, the end of 2021. So, you know.
The end of 2021?
Yeah, the end of 2021. So.
What?
Yeah, maybe that's pushing it a bit, but.
I would hope so.
Yeah, but it just shows you that I think eventually the decision would be taken not by anyone in football. But it was inevitable, I think, that the Dutch would stop. It was made easy by the fact as well that they've got no clubs left in Europe, which I think is an issue, for example, with Scotland, isn't it? With Rangers still being in the Europa League, they can't really finish their season if Rangers still have some games to play in Europe, for example, in August.
Yeah, obviously Scotland, they were due to take a vote, and now it's been held up, and you know it's a bit of a mess in Scotland. Also, it gets all rather political as well. Also because, correct me if I'm wrong, Celtic haven't mathematically won the title in Scotland, right?
No, yeah.
And I wonder what they're going to do as well in Holland, because it was very, very tight at the top.
Yeah, they were level AZ and Ajax. So
yeah,
you can't really give it on goal difference, or can you? Like,
I don't know what they're going to decide. I think that would be patently stupid to give it. You know how I feel about goal difference. I think goal difference is demented. I think head-to-head is demented. I think if teams finish level on points or something significant, you should have a one-game playoff. But hey, I've been arguing that for a long time, and people don't seem to like that. No, goal difference. Or as they call it in the U.S., goal differential.
Which, yes.
Maybe I'm old school, but I think it just sounds completely stupid. But anyway, so about this, them playing in August, I think people are getting way ahead of them playing the Champions League final in August. I think people are getting way, way ahead of themselves here. They're like, you know, UEFA have decided the Champions League final will be on the 27th of August, and they're going to start playing again on the 3rd of August. These are just scenarios, Jules. In fact, my understanding is UEFA look at it, it says, like, well, we just want to get out of the way and let the leagues finish if they want to finish, if they can finish, and then we'll come in later, because obviously with, you know, you've got you have international travel involved in UEFA competition, so they're saying, let's, you know, we'll go to the back of the queue. But I'll tell you what, if everybody could be as good as the Germans and come back and play and finish everything, wrap everything up by June 30th, and there's a chance for UEFA to play the rest of the Champions League in July, or even earlier, if it were safe to do so concurrently with domestic competitions, I'm sure they would jump at the option. Nobody wants to push this further down the road.
Yes, definitely. It's just I think they have to put structure in place. And realistically, if we're being honest, Germany will probably be the only country right now, the only league, at least in the big leagues, that we'll be able to finish on June the 30th, right? Everybody else.
If they can start. That's still TBD for sure.
Yeah, if you want to resume, if you can resume, nothing would be, well, it's very unlikely that any other league apart from Germany would be able to finish by June the 30th. So UEFA being clever and just said, okay, maybe they've got the best scenario possible, and they also have the worst, and the worst is probably finishing in August and playing all through August.
So it was, did you see the document that the German, the Bundesliga circulated, it's in extreme detail with lots of long German words. It said about 240 people per match.
Yeah.
You look at this now, it looks like it's more than 300. There's exact rules about how far apart they all have to stand. I think logistically this is really, really, really tough to get all the testing.
It is. And did you see Jens Lehmann coming up and saying like, oh, you know, we could have 20,000 at the Allianz Arena instead of 65 or whenever, 60. Yeah. And 20 is okay because they can sit three seats apart. And I'm like,
you know
what are you talking about?
Dr. Lehmann is one of my, you know, I have my list of favorite Germans, which, you know, isn't a very long
with
list.
With Opus being top, yeah.
It's, no, they're not German. They're Austrian.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sorry. So.
No, Albert Einstein is up there. He's a very good German. He's one of the Germans we like. I like Marco Reus too. Christoph Metzelder, you know, one or two others. Jens Lehmann is at the opposite of that list. I really, really don't like the dude. I really didn't like him as a player. It's nothing personal. Now that I'm starting to hear him speak, it became a little personal after the Italy-Germany semifinal in Dortmund when the goal goes in to make it 2-0, and he goes and he just like, you know, I'm like, dude, you just conceded 2 goals in 3 minutes, you loser. And then he goes and he kicks out at, I think it was Gilardino.
Yeah.
I also heard those stories, and you might know this because this is Arsenal lore, about how he was very mean to Manuel Almunia when he was there, and he made Almunia cry because Almunia is a sensitive chap.
It's just tough. You know, football is a tough world. It's just tough. That's
if it's tough, man, dude, if it's tough, back it up, dude. You couldn't carry Oliver Kahn's jock, and you know that. And you were terrible when you came to Italy back when Serie A was, back when we were kings. You were you became a running joke, okay?
That's true.
Most of all, I joke. I nothing against the dude. He just wasn't one of my favorite players. But giving medical advice, let's have 20,000 instead of 60,000.
Yeah.
Dude, just shut up. I know we all overreach, and I know we all go out in different directions when we talk about stuff. We don't stay on lane. But, you know, you're way out of your lane here. So,
big time.
Pay cuts are still a big issue. We got a report that Chelsea have reached an agreement, although it's no official announcement yet. You need to help me with this, because they said that they're going to take a 10% pay cut on their monthly wages for the next 4 months.
Yeah.
So I did a little bit of math, and it's basically a 3.3% pay cut on their annual salary. Okay. Yep. Now, this is an actual pay cut. It's not a deferment.
Yes. Yeah.
The Arsenal thing, it was 12.5% on their annual wage. So the Arsenal people were asked to give back four times as much money.
Yeah.
And then obviously with the bonuses, there was a chance they could get some of that back if they qualified for the Champions League, which they obviously weren't. Maybe the Europa League could be a possibility. Who knows, right? That's a huge disparity, isn't it?
It is, but I guess you negotiate. Cesar Azpilicueta was the one negotiating on behalf of the Chelsea squad. Hector Bellerin was the one negotiating on behalf of the Arsenal squad. Every club will have one representative who negotiate with the clubs. I guess you do as best as you can for the interest of your players, your squads. You also want to help the club. I really refuse to believe that anyone who plays for Arsenal, Chelsea, Watford, or whoever club doesn't want to help the club in this current situation. Even Mesut Ozil, I think he had his reasons for not agreeing that pay cut. We'll talk about that in a bit. But so I think you do your best. Initially, I was told Chelsea wanted 30% pay cut for their players. They negotiated down to 10. You could always say that they could have done more. Some haven't done it at all. So it's always a tricky one.
I mean, I think that 30%, of course, wasn't on the annual wages, and I think was a combination of deferred wages.
Yeah, there was all
and
different
cuts.
Options. Yeah.
But what I find interesting, and let's get to Ozil here, because all right, the dude's not particularly popular to begin with, right? Partly because he earns a phenomenal amount of money. I think he's one of the three highest paid players in the Premier League.
Yeah.
His performances haven't been terrible. I think they've just been pretty inconsistent. Certainly hasn't lived up. He hasn't performed like one of the three best players in the Premier League. I think, you know, even his friends and relatives would agree with that.
Yeah.
He obviously had that falling out with your old buddy Unai Emery, right? he has the big crime, even when he's playing well, it's a big crime in England of sometimes looking disinterested, right? Which people love making a huge deal out of. It was obvious that when it turns out that he rejected this negotiated proposal, it was obvious he would be crucified. But Jules, he's not the only one. There's three Arsenal players who said no to this. But funnily enough, do you want to tell me who the other two were?
So there's actually only two, not three. And I will write about this for the website later today with the sort of inside story of the whole thing. Two, not three. I know the second one. I'm not going to tell you now. But
so it's only Mesut Ozil whose name gets dragged through the mud.
Yeah.
So the other ones, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, he's taken the flag for the other one as well. Listen, at the beginning of the negotiation, there was half of the squad who rejected the first sort of proposal by the club. So it was not just Mesut. It was a lot of other players who, you know, wanted to be more negotiating. They wanted to be more time to think about it. They wanted also to see or to know a bit more about the current financial situation of the club, which you can understand. If your club has a lot of money in the bank, why would you accept a pay cut, for example, you know, if they've got enough money to survive this crisis, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yes.
But eventually, down to a squad of 27, only two, as you said, rejected the offer, one being Mesut. He has his reasons. He says that, what I believe is that he gives a lot to charity, even without when it's not the pandemic. He does a lot for people back in Turkey, in Germany, anywhere. He helps a lot of children who are in need. There's a lot of things. So he says he already does a lot. That means right now this is different. This is not a charity in the pure sense of it, you help homeless people.
He's not running a charity, really?
But in the sense that he's helping your club. Yeah. It's helping the business that's been paying you for so many years now. And you could see the argument of why people are cross with him for not helping out. He clearly didn't feel like they needed his pay cut as well, his money.
Here's the here's the thing, right? And I want to stress this very clearly. His agent came and he spoke to our old buddy and colleague, Raf Honigstein, on a podcast for The Athletic on Monday. And he came out and he stressed, and I have to stress this again because this dude's a lawyer, and you know what I think of lawyers and how lawyers are. He's not speaking specifically about the Ozil case. He's speaking in general.
Yeah.
That the way the clubs are going about this is frankly wrong. These are individual contracts. There's no collective bargaining. They tried the collective league-wide bargaining. Obviously, that didn't work. And that you should go and negotiate individual pay cuts with each player. Instead, what the clubs are doing is they're nominating one guy. For Chelsea, it was Azpilicueta, who's the captain. For Arsenal, I guess it's Bellerin. Forgive me, I get so confused about who the Arsenal captain is because, you know, I thought there were five of them.
It's Aubameyang.
Right? Oh, yeah, is it? Oh,
Bellerin
yeah,
who negotiated.
Because Bellerin knows how to use the WhatsApp machine and Obama.
Because he's whatever, a PFA representative.
Uh-huh. Oh, is he? Okay.
Yeah.
They get a player to go and basically negotiate on behalf of the other players. And in some cases, he pointed out, you also get a manager, which again, reportedly, I don't know how involved Arteta was, but certainly from what I've read, and I don't know if you can confirm this, Arteta also got involved telling the players to take the deal or giving them advice on the deal. This is kind of a gigantic, I think, conflict of interest. We had the situation at Juventus where it's Giorgio Chiellini who was out of contract, who was negotiating on behalf of the players. I'm sorry, if it's a negotiation, it's a negotiation. Hector Bellerin is qualified to speak for Hector Bellerin. As far as I know, Hector Bellerin is neither a lawyer.
Hector Bellerin talks to the squads, right? Players in the squad said to Hector, listen, I don't feel comfortable with this. We should do this. Another one said, yeah, I think so, but we could do differently. This is what happens. And then he goes back to the club. It's not just him deciding by himself, right?
No, I'm not saying he's deciding by himself, but you need people, I think, who, in any negotiation, who know what the situation is, who know what the club situation is, who are qualified to go and make that decision. And the point that, and this is why, look, I'm no fan of Mesut Ozil, not as a person, as a player, but his agent had a very good point. Ozil never said, I'm not going to take a pay cut.
No.
He always said, I'm willing to defer my wages. Don't pay me now. Let's see what the figures are later when the figures come out. And we actually can assess what the economic hit. And I think that's a really, really good point.
Yeah.
And now this guy is being crucified left, right, and center. But you know what? He has a point. He's being asked to take a permanent pay cut now, or 12-month pay cut. And yeah, he's overpaid or whatever. That's not his fault, right? Yeah. Without knowing what the actual damage to Arsenal is. Because Arsenal don't know, because they don't know if they're going to restart the season. They haven't run the numbers. They haven't had access to the numbers. I think I'm wearing my union hat. I think he's the sane one here. All these other people are just giving away money willy-nilly. It's one thing if you accept a deferment. It's one thing if you accept, 3% pay cut, whatever, right? It's Chelsea. But to go and take such a big pay cut, if you're Arsenal, without knowing why you're taking this pay cut, without any evidence, without any assessment of what it does for your club, I think is frankly unfair. And I think Ozil's stance and the one of the other mystery person who you may reveal later is the correct one.
But you need some visibility as a club as well. And that's for every club, not just Arsenal, but for every club. You can't just say, okay, maybe, you need to know where you stand in terms of how much money you've got available.
Exactly.
How much money you will save. Yeah, but if every player says, okay, let's take a deferral now, and then we will see later, maybe in 6 weeks, in 8 weeks, in 12 weeks, in 16 weeks. What are the clubs saying? I'll say, okay, potentially we've saved this, but we're not sure. We might have saved this, or maybe we've saved this, or maybe this. But maybe we will have that money back in 4 months, but maybe not. But maybe in 2 months. But this is not clear enough. If you agree or something, whether that's a deferral, a pay cut, whatever, at least the clubs know and they can deal with it. And they can plan for the next few weeks and few months. Do you see what I mean?
No, Jules, because if there's a deferral, the club know exactly what they're saving themselves now, right? The clubs aren't going and spending as much in wages in the next 3 or 4 months. In 4 months' time, when they add up all the numbers, when we know exactly how much they've lost, they can say, okay, guys, you're going to get back this much money. Or you know what? You're not going to get back any money because we've lost more than we anticipated.
Yeah, but
I mean, this is how other clubs have done it. I don't see what the issue here is with Arsenal.
No, it's a great deal for Arsenal. But it's not just Arsenal. But what if those players say, all the players said, well, we want our money back. So you'll have to pay them the wages, their wages for that month, plus the last 4 months of wages that they've deferred as well.
You agree certain parameters, right? You say, okay, in 4 months' time, in 6 months' time, we're going to go back and we're going to be able to show you players, look, we lost 20% of our revenue in this period because of this sponsor and no gates here and whatever else. And so we would like you to take a 20%, and you agreed beforehand you're going to take a 20% cut in wages or whatever it is, right? You create a formula for it. This is what other clubs have done. And I think it's the most reasonable way of doing it rather than just, you know, agreeing. You know, I'm talking from the player's perspective.
Yeah.
Otherwise, just give away your money. I mean, look, I mean, you could make a case to Mesut Ozil, hey, why don't you give money back since you haven't played to your salary? That's fine. I just feel a little sorry for the way he's been hung out to dry. He's been outed, so to speak, right, as the source of all evil. And I just don't think that that's right. Jules, I should have introduced him at the top of the show, but guess what? He's here now. The thing is, he's so in demand at the time, we weren't sure he was able to come on. But thankfully he is, to talk a little bit of Newcastle. Look, it's a non-COVID-19 story. How about that? It's Mark Ogden.
Augie. Morning, guys.
So, Mark, we're going to get into Newcastle. There's a ton going on. You're writing about their prospects of doing a Man City, which I think seem a little fanciful. But there's issues, obviously, with Amnesty International, with beIN Sport. But before we get into that, I want to ask you about the other story you did, the one on footballers and mental health. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the PFA sent a survey around on Saturday to all their members about players' mental health and how they're coping with the coronavirus shutdown. It's been nearly 5 weeks now since the football was suspended in England, so... The PFA get a lot of criticism for obvious reasons, that because their chief exec has been in position for over 30 years, but and he takes a lot of money for doing so. But the PFA have canvassed all the members, and they've set up a COVID-19 email helpline. They've got a 24/7 helpline, and some of the questions that were asked in the survey were quite direct. Have you considered self harm? Have you suffered depression during the lockdown? Do you feel like something awful is about to happen? So it's quite deep stuff. But apparently, they've already had quite a few responses. And between January the 1st and March 31st this year, they had 299 members, players, contacting their helpline. So it shows you that, you know, within the game, there are issues of mental health, which, you know, tend to get overlooked because, you know, football is a sport played by young, healthy athletes, but people forget about the mental and emotional side as well. The 299 that responded were before the coronavirus started. So January the 1st, to March 31st, but I agree. I think times are clearly different now. People are much more willing to talk about their problems. We've had a lot of high-profile footballers have spoken about their issues in the past. You know, Stan Collymore was one. Clark Carlisle was one of the leading figures in the PFA. So I think it's more acceptable. It's just more of the modern-day way of thinking that they will talk about their problems and deal with it. So, you know, 299 in 3 months is a lot, and that's before the actual coronavirus outbreak spike, so it's going to be even more, I'd imagine, during this period when there's no training. So I think the PFA deserve credit for doing this. I mean, I imagine clubs as well, the clubs are keeping in contact on a daily basis with their players, but the fact that the PFA have this there for players to access is a good thing. They have apparently over 200 professionals, you know, counsellors and care workers that are there on hand, you know, outsourced at times, but the network is there, the support network is there, and I think that's a good thing in the sense that a lot of people are struggling with this right now. Footballers are no different.
And I think FIFPro have done the similar thing, and it was the results were quite worrying as well. One player of 10, I think they did a survey with 1,600 players, men and women, and the result was quite frightening. One out of 10 was anxious or depressed or felt depressed or anxious by the lack of football, the lack of not knowing when you would come back playing, the money worries, of course, for a lot of them as well in smaller clubs and things like that. And I think it's something that they have to take seriously. And clubs have psychologists for some of them. Mm. That players can can actually call or have a video phone call with to maybe try to ease those anxieties.
There's also issues as well, which we raised in the question now about players that are struggling to get out of bed, you know, and people might think, well, you know, you're on a lockdown and you're not really working, you can have a lie in bed, but being able to get out of bed is a sign of, you know, possible depression. If people are losing their daily routine and structure and they're not getting up at 8 o'clock, they're getting up at 9:30 instead. So it's quite a detailed survey with questions in it, just to look after the well-being of footballers who, you know, that people say that footballers are 16 years old until the day they retire at 35, and all of a sudden they have to grow up and realise that it's a real world. And footballers have so much done for them. They have meals cooked for them. They have their daily routine is planned out for them. They get up and they go to the training ground and they're told what to do. So when they're at home, left to their own devices and have to manage themselves, a lot of these players aren't equipped to do that because they've never had to do it. So, you know, a lot of people have little sympathy for footballers because they're well paid, they're well looked after, they have the best of everything. But, you know, they're no different to me and you and people in the street.
There's a parallel, I think, sometimes with people in the military as well, who also have that same level of structure and then sometimes struggle when they transition out of it. And we should stress that this isn't just footballers, employers, people in all walks of life who are in this situation now, whether they're at home or they're furloughed or they can't work. And a lot of people struggle with this, and a lot of companies provide this support network for their employees. I want to move on to Newcastle. There's two strands of this. There's a whole political, televisual dimension involving Saudi Arabia. But before we get to that, I want to address what you're writing about in the column, which is basically, doesn't really matter if Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund is richer than Abu Dhabi's. It's not a pissing contest. The reality is it's going to be very difficult for Newcastle to replicate Man City, right?
Absolutely. I mean, basically the drawbridge has been pulled up on wealthy owners coming in and just spending freely to get the best players in the world. You know, we saw it at Chelsea at the outset with Abramovich, and then Man City came along and did it to a different level. And the FFP rules were brought in to stop owners doing the same thing. And obviously, one of the reasons was to stop clubs being run into massive debt. Now, if you're a Saudi prince or an Abu Dhabi sheikh, then you can afford to spend what you like. But it's if Newcastle fans either think that from next season onwards they're going to be able to sign the best players in the world, then it's not going to happen. They have to balance the books. And clearly, you know, they're going to be able to spend more money than under Mike Ashley because they'll be able to generate more commercial income. They'll build the club up, hopefully. But if people think that they're going to go out there with a shopping list of the best five players in the world and sign, you know, X, Y, and Z, it's not going to happen. And that
Mark, before you said if people think that, if Newcastle think, fans think that, that's what you said, I'm quoting verbatim.
Yeah.
There's one thing I've learned on social media, and be prepared for the backlash. Newcastle fans, like most, hate to be patronized. I was shocked when I'm always shocked in this country how every time the national news media bring up Newcastle fans, it's always like, "Well, the passion of the fans, the Geordie army, blah 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 blah," and sometimes they make it seem like they're a bunch of deluded idiots. That was under Ashley, and that is now with this money. Do you really get a sense that fans, I mean, I haven't looked at the local paper, Newcastle, which I think is called the Chronicle, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
I haven't hung out on Newcastle fan forums, like I'm sure you have in researching the story. Are there people saying that? They're like, oh, look, now all of a sudden this guy's richer than Mansour, so we're going to go and do this and that. I mean, are they deluded or are they just saying, hey, look, we're glad that Mike Ashley's gone. Anybody's better than Ashley, and this guy's got a few bob, so we're not going to be insolvent.
Well, I wouldn't say they're deluded, but I think that almost 15 years of being owned by Mike Ashley has left Newcastle fans so desperate for an owner that will spend money. But every football fan wants their owner to spend money, but it's not as simple as spending money. They have to be able to balance the books and not spend more than they earn. Now, Newcastle right now, they don't earn very much. Their commercial revenue is tiny compared to most Premier League clubs. It's rarely grown under Mike Ashley, so they can develop that and then they can spend more on the back of that. But yeah, I do think there's a sense of maybe it's misinformed supporters who believe that the day has come where they can compete like they did in the 1990s with, you know, when they signed Alan Shearer, Faustino Asprilla. It's just not going to happen. And that is one issue they have to overcome, which is a difficult one. But the second issue, which a lot of people overlook, and this will get me some stick from Newcastle fans, is that players tend not to want to go to Newcastle. If they do go there, they want to leave fairly quickly. Now, Kevin Keegan, even in his days when he was signing great players like David Ginola, he found it difficult to attract players to Newcastle because it's a beautiful part of the world. It's a great city, but it's so far from London in terms of, you know, it's a three-hour train journey from London. There are very few direct flights from Newcastle to Buenos Aires or to Madrid or wherever. All the cities that these big players want to go to, want to fly back to. It's an isolated city. And, you know, when Keegan signed Robert Lee from Charlton, I think in 1991, he actually told Robert Lee, don't worry, don't go to Middlesbrough, go to Newcastle, it's closer to London, when clearly it isn't. It's about 50 miles further north. So Newcastle have this geographical issue, which they'll find it difficult. You know, again, talk about patronising ideas. If a footballer flies in from, I don't know, Milan or from Paris and his family there, what are his family going to do? They find that if they go to London, it's great. They can do it. All sorts of things in London. They can shop, they can sightsee, they can live in quiet parts of the world. In Newcastle, they are limited what they can do. And as Jermaine Gina said when he left Newcastle, it's a goldfish bowl. It's a very suffocating place for players to live because it's a one-club city. And the fans are passionate fans in Newcastle. They care about Newcastle morning, noon and night. And it can be difficult for footballers to live in that environment.
The good thing, well, I think they will be very clever and try to target players out of contract because that would be easier with financial fair play. Even if you give a big signing on fee and big wages, it's easier to put that in your books than just go and spend 120 million on someone on top of the wages and the agent fees and et cetera, et cetera. But the issue stays the same. I don't know if Dries Mertens or Edinson Cavani would want to go to Newcastle at this stage of their career when they can have one last big contract somewhere. The other thing is, the other funny thing is that they literally have every agent from everywhere in the world calling to try to sell their players because right now the only club with money, or at least we potentially can spend money and a lot of money in this current situation is them, or at least that's what a lot of agents believe. So you've got, from what I was told, and it's quite funny, you've got pretty much people with big players, and that's fair enough, making contact and this and that, and placing themselves and the players, but also agents like you and me who have rubbish second lower tier players who are still trying to call and say, like, hey, what about my boy? You know, he could do a good job for you. It must be incredible being in the process of buying the club now and also trying to think about what you could go next in terms of recruitment.
This happened at Man City at the outset under Sheikh Mansour. They used certain agents and they made some big mistakes in the first two or three years of Abu Dhabi ownership because they allowed themselves, they called it their accelerated acquisition strategy where they had to sign a lot of players quickly to make them raise to a different level, but they spent a lot of money, they wasted a lot of money. People like Roque Santa Cruz, they paid way over the odds, he barely played. And
but he's such a nice guy.
Oh, exactly. But this is the, mistakes are made and Newcastle...
Roque Santa Cruz is never a mistake because he has class. Mention somebody else. Just don't mention Roque Santa Cruz.
Rubinho.
Thank you.
There you go. Cool. But unless Newcastle have the smart people in place that know straight away what mistakes can be made, if they're going to bring in people that aren't familiar with football, they risk being exploited for two or three years before. Ooh. They'll have to make their mistakes in public. Expensive mistakes.
So... Hey, for now, Lee Charnley is there. I'm assuming he's going to go when the new owner.
That is a suggestion. Yes, definitely.
Amanda Staveley, I'm sure knows a lot of people in football. She brokered this deal and she brokered the Man City deal. I'm assuming in the intervening 10, 11 years, especially since she's going to have a financial stake in the club, she's obviously an intelligent person. You would have to put some faith that she could bring the right people in, right? And then it becomes a question about, like, I mean, in terms of the appeal of Newcastle or not, I think money helps a lot in settling anywhere if you're a superstar. But one thing I found is I think a lot of it is the profile of the player. So if you bring in a young footballer with a young wife or girlfriend or whatever, who, you know, who likes big city life, then that's one thing. In my experience, a lot of the people who've gone to the Northeast, whether to Newcastle or to Middlesbrough or even to Sunderland, people who maybe, you know, are in their late 20s, and this might not be who you want to attract, but who have young families, who've got wives, you give them a big house in the countryside with an indoor swimming pool, they order up a storm, you get them a satellite dish, they watch TV from home, they're happy as a pig in spit. honestly. Like,
okay, that, so you're the Newcastle sporting director. You're trying to sign, okay.
No, no. But,
late 20s, right?
No, no. I'm not saying that for sporting reasons, that's not who you want to sign. But what I'm saying is a lot depends on the profile.
That would be your pitch.
No, but I'm saying is not everybody's unhappy in the Northeast, not every foreign player or even English player. It depends on the profile of what they want. If they want to go and play golf, and if they want the big house in the countryside or ride horses or whatever the hell, then they're fine. I mean, I go back even – yeah, go sure.
Yeah, but, you know, let's use, you know, as an example, David Ginola. You know, he was a great player at Newcastle, but he and his family, after 2 or 3 years, they wanted out, and they ended up in London because London is – a much more attractive place to live.
Well, yeah, of course, but not everybody's in. I mean, look, a lot of players live in Manchester, right? No disrespect, but you know.
I mean, I hate talking about Newcastle like this because I think Newcastle is a great city, but I'm from the north. It's a place that I like, but I'm not Parisian or Madrileño or I'm from Milan. And if you and your family live in Newcastle, and yes, it's a great rural part of the world. If your wife wants to go shopping to the metro centre, she'll quickly get bored of that. It's not like going down Regent Street or anything. It's a great part of the world, but you have to invest in the place. Nobby Solano lived there for 10, 12 years, invested in the place. But a lot of players don't. They find it difficult. Even British players from down south, they find it difficult in the northeast because it's a different way of living, and you have to be invested in that. And I don't think many of them are. I think they'll happily rather sign for Watford because it's near to London.
I want to move it on a little bit to the ownership issue. Obviously, Amnesty International wrote to the Premier League. They voiced a lot of concerns over the Saudi government. I don't want to get into political discussion, but obviously there's been all sorts of human rights allegations. There's a lot of questions there. There's a lot of concerns. I don't want to go down the vicious cycle of whataboutery, because then people will bring it up about Abu Dhabi or Qatar or whatever. Although, personally, I think it is slightly different kettle of fish when it comes to Saudi. But I was struck by Richard Masters, who is the head of the Premier League now, his response to Amnesty International, which he made public, or the Premier League made public, where I presume it was them making public, which is basically like a two-paragraph response. And he came out and he said, look, we have a very stringent fit and proper persons test. We can't talk about it. Now go away, essentially, right? I'm paraphrasing him. Would he have been better off not responding at all?
Well, yeah, because it's opened the can of worms, doesn't it? It makes people, you know, investigate even more, and the scrutiny is even greater now. And people will say, well, this fit and proper persons test, well, you allowed Taksin Shinawatra to take over at Man City not so many years ago when, you know, his regime in Thailand was on the brink of collapse for a variety of reasons. They allowed in Venkis, the Blackburn owners, who were clearly unaware of how to run a football club. So the fit and proper persons test doesn't seem to apply very well in terms of business logic or character. So let's see what happens with the Saudis. But you're right. I mean, people will talk about what about it, because there are regimes with similar political records. So it's difficult, you know. And football is run by money at the end of the day.
And the tricky thing here is that we're talking about essentially a government buying into football. And personally, I have a problem with any government buying into football, because
that's already happened at Man City. So you can't change the rules halfway through if they allow.
Of course you can. You can grandfather them in, and you can say, this is really bad, this isn't good, and let's go forward. And you know, maybe we encourage, you know, even Man City, if you wanted to. Sheikh Mansour it's not like all his money belongs to Abu Dhabi United Group. He no doubt has a personal fortune. You could, if you wanted to, go to them and say, listen, find other investors. They've already been finding other investors. They've got the Chinese in, they've got Silver Lake in. Maybe Mansour invests in it personally. Maybe he gets other of his wealthy mates. It's just when it's an actual government, it's the sovereign wealth fund. That is the money of the people of that country. That's what I have an issue
with. That City would stress that, I've had this told me in the past, that it's not owned by Abu Dhabi. Sheikh Mansour has it, what would you call it, a personal equity play. So it's Sheikh Mansour's personal thing. So they would stress it's not owned by the Abu Dhabi government. So,
is it not owned by Abu Dhabi United Group?
It is, but that is.
And does Sheikh Mansour, is Abu Dhabi United Group belong to Sheikh Mansour?
I was told many years ago by Abu Dhabi that it was the Sheikh's personal equity play. I'm on.
Yeah, you know what? I wish these people, you know what? I honestly, this is my problem with comms people. Either say it straight or shut the hell up. Get out. Go away.
We have to reflect their position, though, just in the sake of balance and fairness.
Right, okay, fine. But their position, what they told you 12 years ago, why can't you tell me how much – is it Mansour's or does it belong to Abu Dhabi United Group? Who does it belong to? Just tell me. What is it? Is it a state secret?
It's Abu Dhabi United Group. That was the transaction at the time, wasn't it?
And Abu Dhabi United Group does not belong to Mansour. Right?
This sounds like question time.
Whatever. I mean, I'm sick and tired of this crap. And this is why we want transparency in football. All right, last question for you, Augie, from me. Anyway, if I'm Steve Bruce, should I be looking at real estate listings elsewhere? Or
big time.
Well, I wouldn't look at a place in Riyadh. I think that'd be wise not to. I mean, it's like Mark Hughes at Man City all those years ago, isn't he? He is, you know, the guy that is in the position right now, but he knows that if you've got wealthy owners who want to make a statement, Steve Bruce, great player as he was at Man United in the early 90s, captain, etc., he's not a sexy name to Saudi owners. They will want, as Jules has wrote, Pochettino or Allegri, these top quality managers that are available. Steve Bruce, great guy for getting the team out of the Championship and keeping them in the Premier League, but I don't think that's what the Saudi owners will want. They will want an Allegri or a Pochettino or whoever else is the big star, Thomas Tuchel's star rising in Europe. So, yeah, if I was Steve Bruce, I'd start looking around at the next opportunity that might come his way.
Well, after Pochettino and Allegri read your column today, I'm sure they probably won't want to take the Newcastle job. Absolutely. Thanks so much, Augie.
Cheers, guys.
All right, Jules, after that chat with Augie, how about we lighten the mood with a bit of Alphabet 11?
Yes.
Brought to you by the letter J.
Yes. Thank you again for all your teams, all your messages. We've picked a few, some impressive ones, some like, come on. So Vinicius Jr. is not J.
No.
His surname is not Junior. This is just not, okay? Vinicius Jr. is a V if you want, but not a J. Okay? That's not... Frankie de Jong is not a J either. Okay? It's a D.
Crystal clear. Boys.
I mean, Junior Firpo is the same. You know, it's the Junior that doesn't work. So sorry for all the people who put, and there was a few Vinicius in their team. Sorry. Even de Jong. Sorry about that. Munir had a 3-4-3 with Jakubovic in goal. Remember when
Is this Munir the former Barcelona striker?
No, it's another one, I believe. Oh. Well, maybe
it could
not.
Be him.
He's got Phil Jones, which is very ballsy, I think, in his team. Tim Yedvai, Christopher Julien, no relation, but I like that he's in there. A midfield four of James, Jorginho, Joan Jordan from Sevilla, and Daniel James, your favorite player ever. And then the front three of Jota, Gabriel Jesus, and Raul Jimenez, which is a pretty strong front three.
Jota, as we call him, but yeah.
Jota, yeah. Riyad Khan has a 4-4-2. Leonard Jardim as a manager, Sam Johnston in goal, Jan Mat, Jagielka, Jones, and Johnny in the back four.
Jagielka is like 50 years old. Jesus, come on.
I know,
man.
But you know, experience is good. Just imagine Phil Jagielka and Phil Jones, who might have played together for England right now. Jajalo and Januzaj to complete that midfield four, and then Gabriel Jesus and Luka Jovic up front. Seth has Brad Jones in goal, Juan Fran, Phil Jones, Juan Jesus, and Reece James, Curtis Jones, Dan James, Januzaj, James, Jesus, and Jovic. We also had Zeke with Rune Janssen, the Hertha Berlin goalkeeper, Juan Fran, Julien, and Jemison at the back, Reece James, Junozovic, Jorginho, Joaquin, and Johnny in midfield, and Jesus and Jimenez up front. We have Blair has Ryan Jack in midfield, which I thought was a really good shout. Fabian Johnson and Tony Janske at the back as well with Phil Jones and Rhys James. Who else do we have there? Noor has Jimenez, Jesus and Jota up front. Jota up front as well with Joaquin, Daniel James, Jorginho, Jan Bakash in midfield as well.
Oh, Jahan Bakash, that's a good one.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's the only one we've had mentioned. We have an All-England 11. Sam Johnston, Reece James, Phil Jones, Jagielka, Carl Jenkinson, James Justin, double J, Bradley Johnson, Curtin Jones, Matt James, and Jukevic and Cameron Jerome, with Kenny Jackett as the manager. Well done.
Cameron Jerome. Wow.
Yeah. And finally, Cordell Thompson with a 3-5-2. Yarsten in goal. Pontus Janssen, Jorgensen, and Jones at the back. Johnny, Junozovic, Jajalo, Jota, and Reece James. And Jorgensen and Jovic up front with Stefan Jobard, the Dijon manager, as a manager. Well done, Cordell. Right. Pretty impressive.
I know you want to hear my J team. Go on. But first, shall we do some women's teams?
Of course. Teams?
Because
of course.
Sophie Lawson, as ever, big thanks to Sophie, hit me up. Now, some of these ladies are Korean, so obviously I'm going to go with their last name, but I'm going to read it first. But she's got Jungbo Ram in goal, Jang Seol-ji, Estelle Johnson, Lotte Janssen, and Celia Jimenez at the back. Rufilo Jane, Ji So-yoon, Sophie Young, and Janet Jakabfi in midfield, and up front, Ellen Mette Jensen and Sofia Jakobsson.
That's interesting. So Miguel Galan, who's a faithful listener and always sends his women's team as well, has a slightly different 4-3-3 formation. Johannes, the German goalkeeper, in goal. Jones Dottier, James Johnson, and Jusinara, the Brazilian defender, the back four. In midfield, Sophie Junge, Celia Jimenez from Spain, and Ji Son-yoon, like Sophie had. And then the front three of Jakobsson, Jensen, and Renato Janssen as well from Holland. So again, two very impressive women's 11. What about yours, Gab?
I think they would probably lose to my team. But in goal, I was very tempted by Jarstein, but then I said, no, I can't have too many German players in here. So instead, yeah, I went with a former Hull City legend, Eldin Jakubovic, who, of course, is on the bench for Leicester right now. At right back, the phenom. I can't believe more people didn't put him there. The man who will change football as we know it. Reece James in midfield. At center back, Jemerson and Juan Jesus from Roma.
Jemerson from Monaco.
Yes.
He's not a football player anymore. The guy is like, he was that good, and now he's in here.
Because look, it's hard to look good if you're going to play alongside Kamil Glick.
No, you had Glick in your
team. Exactly. Hey, I love Monaco, man. I got a place in Captain T. He's down the road from me. Left back Johnny from Wolves, who I think should have been mentioned. Three-man midfield, Curtis Jones, Jorginho, and, of course, Joan Jordan from Sevilla. By the way, Jordan, should we mention ESPN Films?
Oh, my word.
The Michael Jordan thing. I'm not a Jordan fan, but I'm enjoying every minute. I want to say something, though, Jules. You've watched it. It's also available on Netflix around the world.
Yeah.
Jordan's eyes, present-day Jordan. There's something
going on. He's been crying, right? That's the only thing I could...
What, he's been crying for all 10 episodes? All right, I only saw the first two.
They are really red. They are really red.
They're red, they're yellow. It's got no whites. It's creepy, man. I've got three Wolves players in there. I've also have Jota. I have Raul Jimenez. How can you not have Raul Jimenez in this team? And, of course, former Manchester United star, Januzaj.
You don't have Joaquin in your team? What?
Oh, my God. You love Joaquin. I forgot about Joaquin.
I don't want Januzaj in your team.
No. But we got to have Januzaj just to please the United fans. No, okay, Jota can go away, and I'm going to have a front three of Joaquin, Jimenez, and Adnan Januzaj. Sorry, Jota.
Okay. That's impressive. This is mine. I've got Leo Jardim, the Lille reserve, second goalkeeper who will become first choice once Mike Maignan is gone, and he's very good. Back four of Reece James, like you, Christopher Julien, my brother from another mother, Juan Jesus. I can't believe Juan Jesus didn't make your team. And then
he didn't make my team. I told you.
And then James Justin, a left back, double J. Double J should count double points. Juan Jesus, double J. James Justin, double J.
This is true.
Joan Jordan, double J. With Jorginho in midfield, I've got James. You need to have James in your team on one side.
You know, James isn't really his name, but I was unsure about that. But all right.
Joaquin on the other one. And then a front two of Jimenez and Luka Jovic. The Jovic from Frankfurt, right? Not the UK.
Not this present day version's kind of pants. Frankly.
So no Jesse in your team or in my team or in anybody else's team, no?
I didn't want it. An affront to Stoke in Paris Saint-Germain. Come on now.
We should also answer the quiz question.
Yes.
I was asked by Mark Ogden.
Which was too easy.
Was far too easy, man. Come on, Oggy. That was That was poor. And we had a lot of right answers, as you guessed. Kartik, Habib, Simon Yell, M. Piacentini as well, who obviously found Alexis Sanchez, the only player to have played under Marcelo Bielsa, Diego Simeone, Arsene Wenger, Antonio Conte, Pep Guardiola, and Jose Mourinho.
Who do you think he likes most out of all those guys?
It's a good question. Obviously, Simeone was very early on at River, early on in his career. Pep started well, didn't end up well. Arsene, I guess, had a big influence on his career, maybe, and let him do whatever he wanted.
And my guess is Bielsa.
My guess is Bielsa as well.
So now it's everybody's favorite part of the show, some quick hits. Jules, we at ESPN spoke to Raphael, the former Manchester United version, and he had some rather unpleasant words to say about your boy Neymar. Was he willfully misquoted by an evil media, or was he just off message?
He wasn't, because one, it was in English, two, it was videoed, so we've seen it, I've seen it, and you're right.
You sure it wasn't his evil twin brother, Fabio, who they spoke to?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't at all. Neymar can't handle the pressure, he's not a leader, doesn't take criticism well. He should behave off the field, because off the field he's basically doing whatever he wants, and that's no good. That's not why. That's why he's not better on the pitch. I mean, I was gobsmacked by what Rafael had to say on Neymar.
How does he know? By the way, I mean, I guess Rafael has a couple of Brazil caps, maybe, but
yeah, two. He played twice with Neymar, and that's it. The other time that he played was against him, and that's it. And I'm like, wow, okay. So one,
that's how you really feel.
If you ever dreamed again of playing for Brazil, that you can forget about it.
Paris Saint-Germain or Barcelona. Saint-Germain.
Just forget about it.
I don't think he could buy a ticket to get into the Parc des Princes at this stage.
Definitely not. And two, okay, maybe you could comment on Neymar's private life and what he does off the field and the partying and stuff like that, maybe.
And his sister's birthday.
Yeah, but nothing says that he would be a better player if he was a bit less partying, for example. I don't know. And maybe Rafael would be a better player, which wouldn't be too hard if he was partying a bit more. I don't know.
Ooh, that's me.
No, but it's true. On the Neymar is not a leader. A leader doesn't have to be someone who shouts a lot and talks a lot in the dressing room. You know, a leader can be someone who's the best in your team technically. For example, Zinedine Zidane was France's leader for a lot of years, and he was not saying anything in the dressing room. You could not hear his voice. So it's not because Neymar is not the loudest in the dressing room that he's not a leader. So I think that's complete BS. And on the criticism, if it's fair criticism, I think Neymar would probably take it and use it. If it's coming from someone like Rafael, I don't think he would care at all.
All right. Bad Rafael, if you're listening, you've upset Jules.
Yeah, I just didn't think it was needed. That's all. Well, talking about criticism, Romelu Lukaku has been entertaining us a lot with his frequent Instagram lives during this confinement. But Gab, he's in a bit of trouble with Inter, isn't it?
Yeah, look, Romelu is an intelligent guy. He speaks freely. And sometimes when you talk a lot, and I certainly know this, you end up saying things that you wish you hadn't said. He was talking about, you know, the impact of the coronavirus everybody else had. And he said, oh, well, you know, at one point, I think he said like more than 20 in our team had the flu, and maybe they had the coronavirus and we didn't know because we were testing it, blah, blah, blah. And Inter got a bit upset here because they said, I think rightly, wait, we monitor all our players, all our athletes. We had four players who had flu-like symptoms. None of them had coronavirus. And, you know, I think they built this. I think everything's resolved now. He's not going to be punished by the club, as some people wrote. They absolutely love Lukaku. He's not going on the naughty step. But it is... It probably serves as a reminder that when you talk about health matters, maybe, you know, let's kind of watch what we say, and whether he's half joking or not, you know, words weigh heavily, especially at this time, especially when you're talking about going back to playing football and there's a lot of concerns about whether you can do so safely.
Totally.
Right. More stars breaking lockdown. Now, Jules, please tell me what these people have in common. Serge Aurier and Sissoko,
yep.
Alexander Lacazette, Granit Xhaka, Nicolas Pepe, and David Luiz. All these people have been busted. The last four were doing kickabouts together. The first two screwing around. Aurier, by the way, not the first time he's done it. can you tell me what the pattern here is, or do I need to spell it out for you?
I don't know. They all live in North London. They play.
No. They're all either French or they speak French.
Right.
Every single one of them. These are bad, undisciplined habits they picked up. David Luiz learned to do this when he was in Paris.
Yeah,
look,
of course.
We're given instructions. Let's not follow them.
Granit Xhaka doesn't speak French. You know that.
The dude is Swiss. I'm sure he speaks French.
I know, but...
Come on. You really think Granit Xhaka does not speak French?
Listen, they broke the lockdown. It's not something you want them to do. They've been reminded by their club to follow the rules and etc. They were different. The context is a bit different for each of them. Sissoko and Oye went to the park to do some running and, you know, those suicide runs, and maybe they could have been far apart. Listen, I don't want to find any excuse for them. They've got no excuse. They should not have done it, neither of them. And let's hope that until this confinement is lifted or eased, that they won't be doing it again. But it's not a good image. It doesn't reflect good on them, that's for sure. Scott McTominay has been working hard on his middle distance running, and I think it's safe to say, Gab, that he could have had another career.
This is true. The numbers are,
if they're true, they're outstanding.
Of course they're true.
They're outstanding.
What do you think? He goes on a bicycle and like, and then
I don't
like,
know. Like, on his... I don't but, know.
All right. Okay. So he's been doing 5K runs. Okay. Now, Scott McTominay he's a big lad, right? He's got long legs. He's not a powerful guy. He's not like, he's not one of those reedy types.
Kenyan, yeah.
And he's been doing these 5Ks. Oh, and by the way, Granit and Serge and David and Alexandra, this is how you're supposed to train in public. He goes and he runs around whatever sad northern village he lives in, and he comes back and he does it really, really fast. He recorded a time of 15 minutes and 55 seconds in the 5K. Now, if you compare it to Mo Farah, who was the gold medalist, I guess, in 2012, and who is, you know, one-tenth of his size.
In 2016 as well.
2016, whatever. And there's other questions about that guy anyway. He got a 13.41. That's not super fast. However, Mo Farah was running on a track in spikes, yes?
Yes.
Scott McTominay, presumably, is running in running shoes, and he's running outdoors, so it's completely different. It's still, apparently, according to the Daily Mail, so it must be true, this was the 28th fastest time recorded by a Brit, his 15.55 in the 5K. So I think to myself, if Scott McTominay wanted to be a middle distance runner, he probably could have been a really, really good one. Like if he just trained for that and if he ran on a track in track shoes, I think this is really, really impressive.
You know, I would like to see N'Golo Kanté running a 5K and see...
I bet McTominay would wipe the floor with him.
Well, I would like to see this. I would like to see. I don't think
short
so.
Legs.
Don't get me started. I don't think
all
so.
Right. All right, listeners, tell us, who would win, McTominay or Kanté?
Yeah, you all know the answer.
I'm Team
please
Scott.
Send it.
I'm Team McTominay. Sorry, man. Right. Jules, our new teammate here, and we welcome him. We welcomed him last week. Let's welcome him again. Big sloppy kisses to James Ollie. He's reporting that Coutinho could be Chelsea's main target if, as expected, they lose out on Jadon Sancho. Are you buying this?
So I'm buying the idea that they need another creative player, especially when they play against teams, especially at Stamford Bridge, with a very low block, with not much space, and that they need something to unlock those kind of defenses. Fair enough. If they would go for Coutinho for that, I'm not convinced. I have to say, I just, as good as Coutinho is, and I really like Coutinho as a player, I just don't think that's the kind of profile and the kind of player that Frank Lampard and people at Chelsea would go for. You might know better than me and you might disagree with me or agree with me, but I like the idea of, yes, trying to find a player that could unlock in small spaces defenses that play really low. I just don't think Coutinho is the answer.
So first of all, I don't think they've lost out on Jadon Sancho just yet at all. Second of all, Coutinho is on absurd wages and would cost a mint. So unless they get like some, you know, tremendous loan deal from Barcelona, where Barcelona, you know, they pay all his wages and they tuck him into bed at night, I don't see how Chelsea would do that. Thirdly, they have Mason Mount and they have Hakim Ziyech coming in, who, you know, you can say, well, they're not as good as Coutinho, but this is part of why they're brought in. Thirdly, we're going to see a lot more 4-3-3, I think, or, you know, or some version of that without the guy in the hole from Lampard when we ever come back. And Coutinho doesn't necessarily fit into that system, or certainly didn't at Barcelona. So no, I'm not I would find this very, very surprising if it came to pass.
Martin Braithwaite has made just 3 appearances for Barcelona since joining in February to what was quite a surprise move, to be fair.
They needed a striker.
And some say he won't make any more. But Gab, he feels differently, right?
Yes, he certainly does. And good for him. He came out and he says, you know what? I have a 3-year deal here and I plan to stay here for 4 years or more. And I plan to be back. And look, Martin Braithwaite is Martin Braithwaite. He was brought there because the transfer window was closed and because of the screwy registration rules they have in Spain, you can go and pay somebody's buyout clause and bring him in. That should not be allowed. I think that's a bit of a travesty. But putting this guy down when he's played 3 games, look, you know, he's neither Gary Lineker nor Luis Suarez in terms of great Barcelona center forwards of yesteryear. He's not even really a center forward, in my opinion. But you know what? Let him fight his corner. Good for you. Good for you, Martin.
And he's a really good guy. And by the way, if he's listening, him and his wife just had a baby. So congratulations to the Braithwaite family.
Mazel tov, Martin. What is it with... Can I say something? What
is it? French-related again?
No. I was just going to praise Scandinavian players with non-Scandinavian-sounding names, like Martin Braithwaite, or the legendary Albin Ekdal, because these people are intelligent and pleasant, and they're fun to be with.
You know, you also have Scandinavians with Scandinavian names who are clever.
I'm sure there are, but I did not just... Slatan Ibrahimovic, another Scandinavian with non-traditional Scandinavian names who entertains us. Anyway, moving on. Some people get very excited by football kits. I do not. But Jules, I suspect you do. And even I got a little bit excited by Piscata.
Oh, you did?
How could you not?
How could you not? Exactly. They will wear next season, I believe next season, a special shirt. They open a competition for their fans to draw what they would like to, how they would like to see the next shirt, the new shirt. And this 6-year-old boy sent a great drawing of a blue shirt, blue being the Pescara colors in the playing Serie B, with a rainbow and a dolphin sort of headed the ball with his nosing the ball in. And it's a wonderful drawing in the first place, and they made a wonderful shirt with it. So I think good on them. It's the kind of content that I'm here for, basically.
It looks really cool. I know I'm going to buy one as soon as.
You have to. Everyone has to.
Exactly, and in fact, I might buy another one, and maybe we can have it as a prize in a competition because this is really cool. And by the way, for those who don't know, the reason there's a dolphin is that is the symbol. Of Pescara.
The city of Pescara, indeed. Gareth Bale became the latest in a list of high-profile football figures making major donations to health services. He gave €1 million in total to hospitals in Wales and Spain after Guardiola, Ronaldo, Messi, and others. It's a big amount, Gab, isn't it?
It's a big amount, and then you take it as a percentage of his annual earnings, and it's not quite as big. You know, it's the equivalent of somebody making $50,000 a year donating $4,000 to put it within some context.
Yeah, but still.
I think the gesture is important. I don't like it when there's a number attached to it. I don't like these pissing contexts. This one donated more, this one donated less. People have to do what they're comfortable doing. It's great that he's done this. It's great. Just as important, I think, than the amount of money he gives is the fact that, you know, I think he made it public and he talked about it. He doesn't talk very often, but when he publicized it and he underscored, you know, the idea that these people are fighting on the front lines in our health systems aren't alone, that they have a lot of support, encouraging others to give. So well done, Gareth Bale.
Yeah.
Alphonso Davies has a new deal at Bayern. That's quite the turnaround in just over a year.
You're right, Gab. A year ago, he could not even get into the team. Remember, he was a left winger at the time. There was a lot of competition there. And now he's just done a new deal until 2025. He's a left back, one of the best in Europe in the last 3 or 4 months. And taking advantage of all the injuries that Bayern had at the back, the repositioning of Alaba from left back to left center back. And then he got an opportunity and took it. And I think he deserves a lot of credit as a 19-year-old to have been able to adapt so quickly to a new position and improve so drastically to play at that kind of level. We saw him against Chelsea, for example. But like I've said on the show many times, and like I would keep saying, it's a bit too early to say, oh, you know, he's going to be a great left back. He's going to be this, going to be that. He needs a bit more time and he needs to keep working hard. But certainly in terms of potential, he's got everything to get
him
bigger.
I'm not ready to put him in my top 10 of Canadian footballers ever. You know, the list
you've
includes,
got nine better than him.
Well, Dwayne De Rosario and Owen Hargreaves and Atiba Hutchinson and De Guzman and the other De Guzman, Steve Nash. I'm sure there's others I'm forgetting.
Wayne Gretzky, that's seven, yeah.
I'm sure if Wayne Gretzky, even now, if he decided to play football, he would probably be better than Davies because he is the great one. No, look, I just want to say, this guy's a kid.
I'm kidding.
But I have to say, you know, when I don't think I ever saw him play well in that first season when he came in, and you could argue he's adapting and whatever. But to go and reinvent yourself in a new position and to do so well and still do it so young, it's a credit to this guy's professionalism. It's a credit to Bayern for spotting it there. You know, the athletic quality was there, the technical quality. I just think on the wing, it didn't work for him. And he tried something different. Doesn't mean he's got to play left back, by the way, the rest of his career either.
No, that's right.
He's still very, very young. So well done, Alphonso Davies.
And he's also very good on TikTok, as we all know. Well, finally, Gab, Simon Cooper, he's writing about the coronavirus effect on the transfer market for the website. A lot of speculation there. What do you think?
Well, I haven't read it yet, Jules. But, you know, Simon, somebody who's, he writes for the Financial Times as well. He sort of straddles the two worlds of business and football and politics. And of course, he wrote a tremendous, one of the greatest football books ever, Football Against the Enemy. But I'm really looking forward to this. I think there's going to be a lot of implications. You know, it's not just, there's so many things going on at the same time. There's going to be a cash crunch. There's going to be an issue with transfer windows. There's going to be an issue with registration windows. There's been suggestions that some clubs, possibly Manchester United, are just kind of hoarding money and are going to go down and lowball everybody and hoover up all the best players on the cheap around the world. A lot of speculation, a lot of unknowns. When the window does reopen, it's going to be absolutely fascinating. So please check it out. Shout out also to our buddy Tom Hamilton, who wrote a piece about out-of-work managers and what they're doing in their free time. I think definitely worth a read on the website. Jules, we're at the end of the show.
This is it, Gab. It goes so quickly every time, and I can't believe it.
Time flies when you're having a good time, doesn't it?
Exactly.
But we'll be back on Monday.
Monday with the K-Team. Don't forget, we'll have another quiz question as well. And in the meantime, everyone stay safe and enjoy your time.
And stay happy.